Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in Science, Technology, and Society podcast. Thank you very much for joining me today, and I'm very excited to share this book with you. So today's conversation is about Projeet Mukherjee's new book, Doctoring Traditions, Ayurveda, Small Technologies, and Braided Science. This came out in 2016 with the University of Chicago Press. And what the book does is use a series of case studies that in each case look very carefully at the way that the use and engagement with what Projeet calls a small technology, a non-spectacular technology, an everyday technology like the pocket watch, the thermometer, the microscope, produced new ways of materializing body metaphors or produced physiograms in the way that we'll talk about in the moments to come. And collectively resulted in a modernizing of practices and concepts of Ayurveda. And this is particularly in the context of British Bengal in the late 19th to early 20th century. So this is going to be, as you can hear, absolutely required reading for anyone working on medicine, health, its practices and histories in Asia. But it's also really closely and carefully engaged with a number of methodological and historiographical threads and concepts that rooted in science studies much more broadly conceived. So as you'll hear in the conversation to come, Projeet is very, very careful and sort of very clear about the fact that this is also not just a book about the history of medicine, but it's also very much a book about the history of science and the engagement between science and medicine. It's doing all kinds of interesting work that you'll hear about in the hour to come. It's an extensive interview, so I think I'll leave it at that and let you get right to it. But just thank you very much for listening, for your support of the channel, and I hope you enjoy. And I really do hope that you have a chance to get your hands on a copy of the book. There's so much in here that we could only very barely touch on in the course of this conversation and in this medium. And there's so much in there to reward the reader. So get your hands on a copy of the book if you can and enjoy the conversation. And thank you for listening. I'm here today to talk with Projeet Mukherjee about his new book, Doctoring Traditions. Welcome to the New Books in Science, Technology, and Society podcast, Projeet. Thank you, first of all, for writing a really exceptional book that I'm super excited to talk with you about, and also for making time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it. Welcome to the channel.
Thanks, Carla. Thanks for having me here, and I'm looking forward to this, because I've learned a lot from many of our chats over the years, and so I'm sure this is, and I'm sure those things have found their way at some level into the book. So looking forward to this, really.
Well,
thank you.
Well, that's kind of you, and I'm really looking forward to it too. So let's actually start for listeners who haven't had the benefit of knowing you for years, as we've been having these conversations for years. Let's talk about how you came to the field. What brought you, first of all, to the history of science and medicine as a field, and why Ayurveda specifically?
Well, it's actually like I think most of these stories kind of serendipitous. A friend of mine who was a few years my senior at as an undergrad, he got the Rhodes Scholarship from India to go to Oxford, and he wasn't sure if he would be able to come back for fieldwork. And so he asked me to help him photocopy a lot of his primary sources, which were all old newspapers. And I was a senior undergrad then in Calcutta. And it's the first time I saw old newspapers. And I was struck by the ads on the front page. Because I mean, this is true, I've later realized, for most newspapers, but I had no clue that there were, firstly, like tabloids, 19th century newspapers had like almost their entire first page devoted to ads. And moreover, I didn't have any idea that like about 2/3 of those were ads devoted to medicine, and particularly sexual medicine. And I was like, that turned my head about what I thought my great-grandfather's generation were about. I didn't think of them as a kind of Viagra-popping ultra-virahi. So that got me into it, into these. I wanted to initially write a history of advertisements in India in the 19th century, but then I realized the kind of, there was very little background information other than the ads themselves, and I wasn't very keen on doing a kind of art history project, looking at the images alone. So then I kind of zeroed in on most of these ads were about medicine. So, okay, let's go with medicine. So that's what got me into history of medicine initially, and then eventually science.
Great. So the 19th century focus then, it sounds like, was kind of dictated, excuse me, by the nature of the sources that you were interested in. Is that right?
Absolutely. But I also find it an incredibly, because of the range of sources one can still access and the kind of diverse, because I think in Calcutta particularly, which was kind of, for those who don't know, perhaps was a much more important city than it now is in South Asia. It was the capital of the British Empire till 1911. And so there were the sheer variety of voices in it and the variety of conversations is really mind-boggling. I mean, it's and there's a very, very plural print culture, which is unfortunately very ill-preserved today. But by plural, I don't just mean different types of elites speaking amongst themselves, but a print culture that went very deep, that there were presses all over the place, very cheap presses, which gave voice to many different layers of society than you can probably access for other times and other places in South Asia.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. So you've said a little bit about what brought you to Ayurveda and this particular period, and also some of the sources, right, that we can see coming up a little bit in the book. How did you come to focus on this particular way into the topic? And by that, what I mean is not just a focus geographically and temporally, right? So the book focuses on British Bengal between about 1870, which is a period where you locate a rise of a print culture you've talked about, and 1930, but also kind of the emergence or the making of a modern Ayurveda. And I say that in quotes, and I say that as a concept that you bring a lot of real thoughtfulness, right, and like nuance to, rather than taking it for granted. Why this particular approach, and why a monograph that looks at this particular transformation?
Well, you know, I had actually wanted to write a very different book initially about this topic, and I've been like struggling to write this. This was going to be my PhD topic. It was going to be my first book. It ended up being neither. It ended up being my second book. So not because I gave up working on it, but just because I just couldn't find the right structure in which to put everything that I was trying to say in. And there was a very different book, which I actually almost completely wrote out and then decided against it. And that would have been a book that went from the 14th century roughly to the 19th century. And that book was more about trying to also disaggregate Ayurveda as a kind of pan-Indic or pan-South Asian configuration of knowledge, and what was happening in Bengal, and how those two are neither completely distinct from each other, but nor can they be collapsed. Because one thing that's happened in the histories of Ayurveda for the pre-modern period is, I think, they're placeless in a sense. They're all over South Asia. You get people talking about manuscripts found in Xinjiang, but they would be talking as if it was equally valid for all of South Asia. So I wanted to complicate that a bit, but that was getting into more of kind of very complex dynamics about society and caste. And it was taking me away from a focus on the actual knowledge and practices that that I also want to focus on, because I think there's a very rich historiography now, such as Kavita Shivaramakrishnan's work, Rachel Burge's work, which has told us a lot about the modernization of Ayurveda. But what I find is that their stories are all kind of institutional stories. They're telling us about how institutions changed, and they don't get into the actual content of medical knowledge and practice. And that's also something I wanted to do. And I thought if I went down that 14th to 19th century route, it would be a very interesting story, but it would be the backstory to these institutional stories rather than getting into the knowledge and practice, which is, so I eventually decided that that's what I was going to do. I was going to go focus more on this later period, but delve into, when we speak of modern Ayurveda, what is it actually that is modern about it? Not just the infrastructures that are changing, but what changes in terms of knowledge and practice within it.
Great. And that focus on knowledge and practice also brings up, or your invocation of that allows me to bring up something that comes up in the introduction that's, I think, really important throughout the book. And this is kind of your... the way that you are weaving and braiding together, perhaps, and we'll talk about braiding as a figure soon, different strands of historiography to make your story in a way that makes this book really, really useful, not just for people who are interested in the particular sort of subdiscipline that you're working in, right? South Asia, history of medicine, the interaction between medicine and science, but also much more broadly. This is a book that contributes to a number of different historiographical kind of questions and threads and themes. And that's one of the reasons I think it's so important. And one of the kind of major historiographical threads that comes up, speaking of what you were just talking about, is Charles Rosenberg's idea of therapeutic change.
Right.
Right. So this comes up over and over again. And I'll perhaps ask you about that a little bit later. But I just want to mark over the course of our conversation some of these ideas that come up that seem really important to the work that's happening in the book, and that you're very generous, right, about acknowledging and bringing into your story by name, which not everybody does. And so I think that's something that's also really impressive. Okay, so before we get to therapeutic change and before we get to some of these, let's get to medicine bottles, right? So now, listeners, we're going to get right into the book. Right on the first page of the introduction, you talk about this kind of object that we're going to see again in the course of the narrative of the book. And this is an object that in many ways kind of frames the whole story. We see it at the beginning and we see it at the end. And this is medicine bottle. So, Projit, you talk here about your hobby of collecting old medicine bottles. Can you maybe start bringing us into the story by talking a little bit about that? Like, why, first of all? And how does this hobby kind of like interfinger with the work that the book is doing?
Well, the medicine bottles, the hobby is kind of, I wish I could show you. I have like... I think over 300 bottles now in my collection.
Wow.
For somebody who has, in the course of his professional career, had to move over three continents, moving these bottles is one of our biggest logistic challenges when we move.
I can imagine.
And they're dearer to me than a lot of really much more expensive things. and so I it like old glass fascinates me. You know, when I was growing up in Calcutta, this was a world with a lot less color than we have today. And because this was still a Cold War childhood, we were broadly in the Soviet bloc, so to speak, by the time I was born, at least. And there weren't, like, TV used to be quite bland and black and white. There wasn't any Coca-Cola or Hollywood movies. Daily life had a lot less color. And the one thing that did have color were these itinerant men who would buy up old bottles. They would come with big sacks on their backs and ask for old bottles, and then you would bring out whatever bottles you have, or your mother would usually, and they would weigh them and give you some money and take away the bottles. And I found his sacks incredibly exciting because they had all these brilliantly colored old glass bottles. So that's kind of, I think, the root of my fascination with these bottles. But like I said, like, they've grown, and I've continued to carry them around like a snail on my back. And so the way it intersects with the story, like I say in the book, is I found this bottle, which was kind of almost like a holy grail to me, in, of all places, in a farmer's market in Philadelphia, right after I moved to Philadelphia. And I asked the guy where he found the bottle, and he said he had dug it up from a old Victorian rubbish dump in Pittsburgh. And this is something that there is a small market in old bottles now, and people look up where old rubbish tips were and go and dig up and then sell them. And so it was fascinating to me that this little bottle, which had once contained an Ayurvedic medicated hair oil with three Indian scripts embossed on the side of the bottle, had traveled all the way from South Asia to Pittsburgh in the 1890s. And it just got me thinking as to what were the kind of frameworks within which this object could move, and what were the kind of frameworks within which the producer and the consumer imagined each other in the 1890s in Pittsburgh and Calcutta, respectively.
Fabulous. And I'll just mention very briefly for listeners who are particularly interested in this, that you're mentioning color and the importance of color just now also evokes something that happens later in the book. So for listeners who are particularly interested in that, there's a whole chapter that looks at the importance of light and that touches on as well the importance of color for some of this story. So we'll get to that in a little bit. Now, the core of the book is structured around five case studies. These are case studies that occupy chapters 2 through 6 that describe the incorporation of a particular technology into Ayurvedic practice, resulting in what you call a braiding together of strands of sciences and the production of a new body image. So there are at least a couple of elements of that description that I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about, because they're absolutely central to the work that the book is doing. Now, the first is this idea of braiding. So you integrate this, and you really kind of use and talk about this idea of braiding sciences throughout the book. This is one of the core ideas and contributions methodologically to, I think, a number of fields. So, Projit, can you talk a little bit about that? What is braiding sciences for you, and what does it do that other kind of historiographical notions fall short of or don't let you do in the same way?
I'm really invested in this idea of braiding sciences, so thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk about it. It's basically what I want to do, again, is like coming out of my own training, which is most of which was in South Asia. I was born and raised there. I did most of my education there, and I only went to England to do my PhD. So everything till before that, I learned in South Asia. And my training was in universities and by professors who were mostly off a very kind of critical left position. And so this was a moment of great change in the 1990s in India, when our political spectrum was beginning to lurch uncomfortably to the right, which unfortunately it has continued to do since. One of the main challenges for us was how to be how to write histories that were anti-colonial and non-nationalist and kind of disputed any kind of essentialist idea of the nation, or to use Prasenjit Dwara's term, how to save history from the nation. This was a very immediate, everyday challenge that I can go into, but I'll avoid now going into the various kind of everyday ways in which history was being forced to take a stand against xenophobic essentialist nationalism in South Asia in the 1990s. I was always very dissatisfied with these moves for global versus local, or even I think in its latest iteration, this, which I find very promising, this go-betweens literature or the circulation literature. I find it very productive. But what I always am disappointed by is that it becomes a transaction between savant elites on both sides. And there's a way in which willy-nilly, whether consciously or not, a kind of binary is reproduced in which there's a kind of, there's the West and then there's India, China, whatever is the place you're talking about, that gets homogenized in a way as well. And so what I wanted to do with Braiding was I was trying to find a frame that would tell me, that would allow me to tell a story that brought out the plurality on both sides. So not just the plurality on the non-Western side, but also the plurality on the Western side. And I thought, and particularly also bring in the subalterns. My training has been within the subaltern studies tradition. My supervisor was one of the founders of the subaltern studies project. So I also wanted to bring in the subaltern. So if you have these three groups, then you have, like, in a sense, the European elites with all their plurality. You have the colonized elite with all its plurality, and you have the subaltern with all their plurality. And how does one tell a story that does not reduce any one of these sides to a kind of homogenous blob? And I thought the way to do it is if we see all of these traditions as being internally diverse and heterogeneous and comprised of multiple strands, and then we see individual people and objects as bringing specific strands together and braiding them together. Braiding is also a metaphor I like because it avoids the kind of hybridity talk, which I find very race-inflected. And also because hybridity kind of assumes then two pure ancestors, and I'm kind of resistant to purity in essence in every way. And so I want to think of, like, braids are things which look beautiful. They could be, you could make patterns out of them, but they could also be unraveled at a later date. So they do not necessarily constitute yet another essence. That's generally, I think my thinking on braiding. It's something that brings out the plurality, and it's something that avoids essences, something that avoids, that tries to be anti-colonial while also not falling into the seductions of nationalist essentialism.
Now, one of the kinds of things that affects or that enables this kind of braiding is the use of, the integration of, the engagement with small everyday technologies, right? Non-spectacular technologies, you call them. And the book focuses on a number of small, what you call, and this is a quote from the book, small, non-spectacular, and everyday technologies as motors or catalysts of change. And we'll talk about those as we get to through some of the chapters in our conversation today. But another kind of thing that's produced, aside from the braiding, by these technologies is a series of what you call physiograms. So this is another key aspect of the analysis. And in addition to pointing out an important or a number of important small everyday technologies in each chapter, you also point out particular physiograms that emerge in the context of each chapter. Now, you're very explicit in saying that this notion draws on John Tresh's notion of cosmograms, and listeners of the channel will perhaps recall that the conversation with him about his book some time ago, but this is actually doing work that's quite different. And so could you, for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, talk about this notion of physiograms and the work that it's doing for you here?
Well, the physiograms, I think, again, come out of partly also the kind of interdisciplinarity in practice that you mentioned that I try to engage in the book. I'm drawing a lot, as you would have seen, on anthropological literature. For instance, I'm really... I draw, and I mentioned this in the book as well, I draw, for instance, also on Steve Fireman's work and what he calls kind of folk anatomy and kind of trying to reconstruct. And this is something, of course, anthropologists do. They construct reconstruct knowledges that are all not written down often. And again, as somebody who's been interested in subalternity, I've struggled with this, how to reconstruct knowledges that aren't explicitly written down. The one thing where I kind of am less comfortable with that anthropological literature is because of the generalization at the level of culture. And that, again, because of this, like the boogeyman of nationalism, of whom I'm really scared and want to have nothing to do with, I do not want to generalize at the level of culture as a whole. And so neither do I want to drown in individual case studies, because I do aspire to being able to say something more than here's this one particular healer I studied. A lot of ethnographies, I don't mean like, I think actually your book is a great example of how you can use one particular person.
I knew that was coming. It's like, he's going to hear himself say that, then he's going to be like, but not your book. It's totally cool. It's fine. Go on.
No, I was thinking more of, you know, there are books I love. Like, for instance, there's a book by Joyce Flukiger called In Amma's Healing Room. I love that book because, again, it's an ethnographic work devoted to a single, very subaltern healer in Hyderabad. And she tries to make some general cases, points from that. And so I was looking for something that would allow me to do that historically, that would not be about the study of a single person, but would not necessarily generalize at the level of culture. So I was in search for some kind of middle-level generality. And that's where, and Conversations with John has been incredibly, incredibly productive for me. I mean, I can't acknowledge him enough. Having him as a colleague is wonderful, and it kind of is such a generous and imaginative historian that I always find engaging with him and his ideas extremely productive. So he had this idea of materialized cosmologies, which were kind of middle-level generalizations about the cosmos, which weren't shared by everybody, but neither were they reducible to a single individual. They were sort of things that were incomplete, but you could see them in the work of multiple individuals at a given moment. And I took that on, and I came up with physiograms, which I think of as kind of materialized physiologies or body images. And this, again, goes back also to Charles Rosenberg's therapeutic change argument, where he thinks that what really allows you to map therapeutic change in all its diversity is the change in the way the body is understood. So what he calls the body metaphor. And again, like, how to come up with a more plural idea of body metaphor, where I don't say that all Bengali Ayurvedists thought this, but I can say that there were these kind of broadly shared images of the body, which you can see materialized in practice and writings of multiple practicing Ayurvedists in this period. So that's how I kind of get to physiograms, and that's what I'm trying to do with it.
And one of the things that's really interesting about the book, from the perspective of practice and historiography, is the way that you're accessing these physiograms through really a variety of kinds of writings. And so one of the things that's really striking, and this comes up, I think, in chapter one for the first time, is that you're also using fiction as an important source to get at some of this. There's one novel, or there's one of work of fiction in particular called Arogyo Niketan, is that right?
Yeah.
That comes up at the very beginning, and that you constantly come back to. Can you talk a little bit, just very briefly, about the importance of fiction to the work that you're doing in the book, and of that novel in particular to what's happening here?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I could go on forever on fiction and history because that's like really something I love. Yeah. But this particular novel is a very interesting one. It's also been made into a movie. It was a very critically acclaimed novel when it came out in the 1950s, got a big literary award in India. But what I'd never realized, and it kind of... has a lot. It tells the story of three generations of Ayurvedic physicians in a small little village in Western Bengal and how their world and how their practice changes over this period. And it's animated through clash between a very idealistic modern doctor who has been right after independence sent out is a biomedically trained doctor sent out by the government and absolutely has no time for traditional medicine, quote unquote, and thinks Ayurveda is a bunch of bunkum and this clash and how it unfolds and the gradual mutual recognizability that emerges between him and the aging scion of this dynasty of Ayurvedic physicians. It's a fascinating story, but what I didn't know and discovered during my field work in my PhD years was that when this author, who's a very well-known literary author, when he was writing this book, he was also into politics and he was a member of the local legislative assembly elected in the very first elections after Indian independence. And his best friend in the political party was this guy who was, again, a very eminent Ayurvedist and scion of a long and very respected Ayurvedic dynasty. And so when he was writing this novel, he actually discussed drafts with this guy. So its status as fiction, it has always been seen as a fiction, but the novel is, I think, somewhere in between novel per se as a complete work of fiction and a memoir of his friend and his take on the world. So that novel I find is actually, it's not even completely fiction in that sense. It's a different kind of genre which has only been understood as a novel, but it has these wonderful insights which I think work really well to bring out some of the complexity of the stories that I'm trying to tell.
I think it works super well in your narrative, and we won't talk about this now, but at some point, at some conference in the future, I think you have a whole book on science, medicine, and fiction that's brewing in you. And so I'm going to try to convince you to write that book, but not right now. We'll talk about this book now. So you talked, okay, so there's a chapter of the book before we get into these case studies that is really important, but we won't have time to talk about in detail here. This is chapter one, and this is a chapter that offers a kind of what the book calls historico-sociological map of the people who engaged with the process of modernizing Ayurveda. Now, this is really important. This is why I want to mention this, in part because it's taking on and complicating and kind of opening up some major sociological and historical categories for the purpose of what's to come. And those include looking at the significance of class and middle classness in particular, refocusing attention from caste to localized units called jatis, and really situating us within kind of Bengal, within the dominance of a kind of urban culture there of Calcutta, and bringing out also the importance of Sanskrit and English to some of what's happening here. And so it does really important work, and I want to just flag it for listeners because it's an important bedrock for what's to come. But I want to get to the clockwork body. So we can come back to elements of that whenever you want, Pradeep, but sure. We're going to move for now to chapter two. Now, chapter two looks at the physiogram of the clockwork body. And the everyday technology that facilitates this is the pocket watch. Now, there's a lot that we can talk about here, but just as a kind of example of how these everyday technologies interfigure with and produce these physiograms, let's talk a little bit about the relationship between the pocket watch and this clockwork body. Just very briefly, you talk here about the importance of the pulse as a site of intense boundary marking and boundary making. And one of the things that's happening here is you're showing us through this kind of history of the use and practices around the pocket watch, the ways that the pulse as a sort of marker of boundaries was marking different ways, for example, of measuring time, right? Mm-hmm. And the existence of alternate temporal cultures. So mm-hmm. for you, I think that I'm just going to hit this ball back to you. What for you is most fascinating about the kind of work that's happening here, using the pocket watch to produce this physiogram of the clockwork body and the kinds of pluralities that this lets us see that we might not otherwise see?
Well, of course, I mean, as you know, pulse has such an iconic importance for so many so-called quote-unquote traditional medicines. And it's so easy to also write pulse into a very kind of Whiggish teleological history where, oh, everybody was fumbling around the same basic thing. And then we got to, and then it, so sort of straight line from there into other things. Whereas we know, of course, from, and there's, it continues to be fascinating work. I mean, recently I've been fascinated by Tatiana Chudakova, I think is the name.
Oh, yeah.
Her work, for instance, on trying to mechanize pulse in the Soviet Union.
Oh, and yeah. Her work is awesome.
It's really awesome. Yeah. And so I think pulse is interesting for me because it is so easy to miss the pluralities in it and to see it as just one common universal thing. And that was somehow like that reinforces various Whiggish narratives. Whereas once you start looking at it, it opens up this enormous plurality that's kind of there, so widely dispersed. And it's also this iconic diagnostic technique, which again, I mean, it's not there, like I mentioned in the chapter, it's not there in classical Ayurvedic texts. It's not there in Charaka Samhita. It's not there in Shashruta Samhita. It's not there in Vagabhata, the three canonical texts. It comes up kind of out of the blue in around the 13th, 14th century, and then continues to grow in importance. But it gets radically transformed in the 19th century once you have the pocket watch. And the pocket watch, what I'm trying to argue, and this goes back to that previous chapter that we skipped over, the reason somebody wants to have a pocket watch is not actually medical, in my view, originally, but it's because you're kind of like Victorian middle classes across the world. You kind of define your class identity as a middle class person by consuming things like pocket watches. If you're a respectable gentleman, you have a pocket watch on a gold chain in your pocket. And so a lot of these elite Ayurvedists are doing that, I feel. And then at some point, once they have it, they're producing all this. And I tried to show this in the chapter that they're producing initially this new numeralized data about the pulse instead of the kind of qualitative data, which was more about, oh, this pulse is like the gait of a marsh snipe or like the gait of a snake or a frog. Instead of that, you're now getting like numeralized counts of pulses, mm-hmm. but they don't quite know how that fits into their imagination of the body. So then once the data is produced, you need to make sense of that data. And that's where the braiding happens, by drawing on very specific strands of electromagnetism, by drawing on very specific strands within the Ayurvedic heritage. It kind of braids them together and creates this, what I'm calling the clockwork body, where the body is increasingly imagined. And this is, again, a familiar theme for Western historians of science, that the body being imagined as a clock, as mm-hmm. a kind of clockwork. But I think the Ayurvedists taking it on are making it do slightly different things. It's also, they can never, partly because they're also working through internalized Orientalist categories of mm-hmm. the spiritual East and stuff. And that's getting, so mechanism, and again, this, and you can hear echoes perhaps of John's work here once more, that like mechanism and vitalism are not two poles, but kind of cross-fertilize and braid into one another in this clockwork body.
That's right. And one of the really interesting kinds of implications, or a number of the kinds of implications that come from this, are not just about, and you show us this, right, sort of engaging data, understanding how to practice, you know, with pulses of various sorts. And I use that term very loosely, but also, and this is the point that I wanted to get to, you're showing here, among other things, that the pocket watch is also enabling or facilitating a shift in bedside manners, a shift in the kind of affective responses happening in the patient-physician relationship, and it also enhances the authority of the physician. So there's a lot of kinds of work that these technologies are doing that may not be obvious that the chapters really bring out, and I think this is a beautiful example of that. Now we move from here to several more physiograms. We won't have a chance to talk about each one, but the next one I think we should at least touch on, and this is chapter 3, which explores the physiogram of what you call the Snyubic man. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a physiogram that's produced through the everyday technology of the thermometer. And there's so much we could talk about here, right? I mean, the chapter talks about notions of body heat, relationships between body heat and fever, kind of opening up what we think we're talking about when we talk about fever. It talks about the significance of letters as sources for understanding conversations about illness. There's lots and lots of stuff happening here. But one of the really interesting things is your discussion of these things, snayus. Am I pronouncing? Mm-hmm. I pronounce everything wrong, but like I'm just going to give that a
You're
shot.
You're pronouncing
okay.
everything Snayus. Perfectly.
Yay! so you show us the existence of these things, snayus, which may look like they are mapping onto a nervous system, but they're importantly different when they're mapped onto a body from what's mm-hmm. happening in kind of a more conventional nervous system diagram. And that difference becomes actually really important. So what mm-hmm. is Snyubic man, and how does that come out of, or what's for you perhaps most interesting about the way that comes out of engagement with a thermometer?
Well, I think this Snyubic man, the kind of that's the one physiogram for which I actually have an illustration, I think, which is great because it helps me anchor my thoughts in an actual image. So this image is on page 153. And you can see the image. And what's really exciting about that image for me is that this is this weird book where you have the page actually split in half. And there's an Ayurveda discussion of various diagnostic technologies going on the top half. And the bottom half, which is supposed to be a footnote, is almost as in terms of space, almost as large as the upper half. And it's telling you a completely parallel story about how the uses of thermometers and uses of other kinds of tests, including, say, urine tests and stuff, are going on. But the image that you will see on 153 is two things I would like to say about it. One is that if you picked up that image and saw it, you'd see that there's no brain. Mm-hmm. The image gets, and this is particularly interesting for me because I think there is, as a number of people have argued recently, that the modern personhood from the late 19th century, increasingly through neurology and other things, gets reduced to brainhood. And it becomes like we think of ourselves as our little brains. And so nowadays people want to like freeze their brains when they die so that if they ever come back. But they don't need the rest of the body. They just need the brain. So it's quite interesting that this conversation on the Ayurvedic side, which is drawing on these very same currents of, or a lot of the overlapping currents about nerves and nervous systems, does away with the brain altogether. And so it becomes a kind of hydraulic system where things flow evenly. So the head space in that image is just like a bunch of nerves again. So it's a properly circulatory image. And I think this is radically transforming what the doshas, which are usually translated as humors, but I don't want to translate them as humors, as I'd say in the book, but Vayu, Pitta, Kapha, the three kind of Tara humors, if you will, that are central to Ayurvedic pathogenesis, they're not imagined as fluids that flow around the three similar fluids. They're imagined, they're subdivided into five parts each. Each part is thought to be in a particular place in the body. Disease happens not just by imbalance, as like 10 million popular Ayurvedic books tell you, but it's but it happens because of the particular subhumor being displaced from the place. So it's as much about misplacement. So this whole idea of a uniform body space where things just flow around and need to be in balance is a very hydraulic metaphor, which homogenizes the internal space of the body. And all of that happens through this idea of heat initially, because once they start getting an idea about body heat as an index of fever, and fever is, of course, one of the master pathogenic categories or pathological categories, I should say. It is the disease, as it were. And once you kind of tag it on to heat, heat becomes something quantifiable, and you're trying to make sense of heat by drawing on all these conversations about electromagnetism. And that's where I think we start constructing this uniform, homogenized body space that is going to become central to modern Ayurveda.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And so there's so much going on in that chapter. There are also a number of other chapters following this that I'll just kind of briefly mention that are doing functionally similar kinds of work insofar as they are presenting one or more key everyday technologies that are generating new materializations of kind of body concepts. So chapter 4 looks at vision and seeing, and it presents a story about the way that the microscope facilitated the emergence of the what you call the chiaroscuric man, the physiogram. Mm-hmm. This is the chapter that invokes color in the way that I mentioned a little bit earlier in our conversation. And it looks at the braiding of different kinds of seeing, right, that are happening mm-hmm. through an engagement with microscope technology and pays some really interesting attention to Ayurvedic germ theory, cell theory, and the ways that looking at worms, for example, kind of generated ways of thinking about germ theory. Chapter 5 looks at what you call the endocrino-chakric machine. So you look here at the technology of organotherapy or injecting organ extracts, right? Mm-hmm. And the kind of relationship between that and the modern incorporation of chakras into Ayurvedic writing. There's also a really interesting, just for listeners, I'll mention this, a really interesting discussion of the significance of radio technology to what's happening mm-hmm. in this chapter. So there's a lot going on here that we won't have time to go into in detail, but that's not to say it's not fascinating and important. It's entirely about time. But this brings us to the chapter 6, which is actually doing a really interesting kind of work that's importantly different from these chapters that we've either talked about in detail or just kind of very briefly touched on. This is because while chapter 6 looks at the importance of a technology, chapter 6 is looking at the body of the physician as a form of technology. And this is a chapter that considers how, and this is in the words of the book, the physician's body as technology was remade in the course of the modernization of Ayurveda. Now, you say here, kind of early on in this chapter, that there are a couple of related, but not necessarily, well, there are at least a couple of related things that are happening with the body of the physician that are important here. At the same time, the body of the physician is itself denied the power of diagnostic reasoning, but it becomes a crucial medium through which sensory data is collected. Okay. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more happening here that we'll talk about. But just to kind of get us started a little bit in terms of talking about this chapter, can you talk about that part of it? Like, what's happening in terms of this simultaneous or maybe roughly simultaneous or coterminous transformation of the physician's body so that it becomes both crucial and also unreliable diagnostically?
Well, I think before that, if I could just add a word. Sure. So this chapter has an interesting history of its own. It wasn't part of the original manuscript I'd submitted. And I got two extremely generous referee reports back from the University of Chicago. And they were, I was over the moon. The referees, both referees, didn't want a single thing changed. They were very happy with it. And it was a very, very good exercise. But one referee mentioned that, you're talking about all these everyday technologies. And of course, the body of the healer is also a technology. And I was at that point, the penny just dropped. It was, yes, that is it. And that's what I've been thinking about all the while. And why didn't I put it in? So I went back to my editor, Karen Darling, and said, like, can I add another chapter? And she's like, no, it's gone through the referee process. We can't do it. It's going to delay everything a lot. And I'm like, but I insisted that once the bug was in my head, I had to write it. And I'm like, I'm going to give it to you in 2 days. She said, but we'll still have to get it. Yeah. So she said, we'll still have to referee it. And I'm like, okay, but I still want it because I think it's absolutely crucial now that I've thought about it. And it was actually, it was a chapter literally written in about 8 or 9 hours.
Oh my gosh.
From start to finish. And it was because it was all there, but I needed that very generous referee, whoever that is out there in the world, thank you very much, to make me see it. And his or her comment kind of made me see that it was there. And so it was written in this 8-hour mad rush over like 3 cups of coffee or something. and so I just wanted to throw it in there as a kind of interesting side detail to the writing of the book. But to get back to your question about what is going on in terms of the body of the body of the physician, I also find these music metaphors, which I used to train again in the pulse texts throughout the 13th century. That's one of the areas where the body of the physician is most important, because you have to tune your body as a physician to the body of the patient. And it's actually the image is used as one of tuning, like you're it's always different musical instruments that are invoked. And that it's also interesting how that changes from a sitar to a violin through the coming of modernity. What you the practice of bodily cultivation as a healer. And at the point when it shifts, I think in the around the turn of the 20th century, when it shifts, that's when this shift happens from the body of the healer being a diagnostic technology to it being a technology useful in the making of medicines with a small m. So its function completely changes, because diagnostically it has been displaced now. So diagnostically, pulse is read with a pocket watch. You are using a thermometer. You're using probably also urine tests and such like. And so the importance of the physician's body as a diagnostic tool declines. But where it comes up is in making the medicine. So there are these constant protestations that the physician personally selects the herbs, that they manufacture the herbs in a way that is ritually pure, that the physician's body is ritually pure when he's, so to speak, cooking the medicines. And so this flip from the physician's body being functionally important to diagnosis to it being functionally important to the production of medicines. That is, I think, the flip that I'm trying to talk about.
Great. And you do talk here about the importance of the way the physician's body or the physician itself is reconfigured as a gem collector, right? And here, also, these medicine bottles come back in. So I need to just kind of mention this because, as you've mentioned, the importance of medicines or pharmacy perhaps comes in really importantly in this chapter. You talk about the way that practice becomes increasingly equated with knowledge and competence in pharmacy. And those pharmaceutical elements are specifically liquid. And so the chapter pays really, I think, interesting attention to the importance of material culture insofar that it's looking at the connection between the rise and importance of a particular kind of liquid medicines, passions, extracts or astringents, and the relationship between that and the fact that medicine bottles had become iconic signs of medical modernity. And so there's a really interesting focus on medicine bottles, on material culture, on liquids and liquidity, and on pharmacy here in Chapter 6 for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read it. Now, this brings us, Parjeet, to the conclusion, which does much more than merely summing up what's happening prior to the conclusion in the book. It does that work as well, briefly, in the first part. But in the second part, the conclusion offers us an account of what did not make it into modern Ayurveda, what you call the styles of thinking about the body that became impossible as a result of the kinds of modernizing processes that the book recounts. Now, there are a number of interrelated examples that you talk about here in this part of the book, but I'll ask you perhaps to talk about one of them that comes up, and feel free to bring in others if you'd like. You talk about the idea of the hyperphysical body as one of these elements that did not make it into modern Ayurveda. Can you perhaps use this as an example to illustrate kind of what you're talking about here in the conclusion, and talk about why this is so important?
Sure. And this is also going to give me a chance to acknowledge my debt to two other authors, anthropologists, from whom I've learned and borrowed a lot. One is Jean Langford, whose work Fluent Bodies was enormously liberating at grad school when I first encountered it. I mean, the imaginativeness and the kind of the way she actually looked at, instead of the Indological work and the classical studies work, which was interesting in its own way, but didn't see some of the like creativity in the modern modern versions of Ayurveda. So Jean's book did that. However, the one thing I was kind of uncomfortable with again was this kind of clear polarization between what she called a fluent body of Ayurveda and a docile body of biomedicine. And I thought, well, the biomedical body is not singular, and neither is the Ayurvedic body. And the modernization process actually, I think, makes the body somewhat, the Ayurvedic body, more compatible with biomedicine. You see that increasingly now with so much of overlap with, I don't want to call it biomedicalization in a kind of clear zero-sum way, but there is an increasing tendency within mainstream Ayurveda to use more and more biomedical technologies, biomedical concepts, and there's a lot of cross-fertilization happening. So the bodies are not as incompatible. However, having said that, I also recognized from Jean's work that there is something that is getting lost, that was quite incompatible with Ayurveda. I just didn't think that Ayurveda in its modern form remains that incompatible. So what I wanted to do in this chapter is look at, okay, Ayurveda produces, modern Ayurveda, quote unquote, produces this new body image, which is more compatible with the biomedical body, but not exactly similar either. But there is something that is lost, something that is even more radically different that cannot be accommodated. And part of that, I think central to that, is this idea of the hyperphysical body. The hyperphysical body is a body that can that is firstly not organized around a rationalized internal space. So you can have, for instance, these chakras where you keep digging deeper and deeper into chakras. What Ayurvedists since the 1920s have tried to do, even now try to do, is say the chakras are just metaphors for synapses or something else, some other organic structure. But if you actually read them, you dig deeper into the chakras, and at some point you're no longer within the body, but you're in this cosmic space where gods inhabit, gods and the entire cosmos kind of inhabits within that single chakra. So it's not a space that's amenable to spatial rationalization. And it, in trying to think of this, I was really inspired by Joe Alter's work, whose work I find enormously educative and inspiring. Joe had this argument about a very different notion of health in certain South Asian healing traditions, where health is not the return from some kind of dysfunctionality back to functionality, or from abnormality back into some version of normality. But health is something that is that doesn't have an end. You can continue to cultivate it forever. And the end point is humans eventually become superhuman. So you acquire these siddhis and you become superhumans, and you become immortal, you become invisible, you become capable of mind control and flight and all these superhuman possibilities. So health is seen not as a mere return to the normal, but a kind of an infinite avenue for transcendence. And I think the hyperphysical body is at the base of that, where its cultivation is not about just extending biological life. So it's not biopolitical in that sense. It is biomoral, but it is also biotranscendental in a sense that it is about a body that is not rationalizable, that is not tied to just simple biological life and longevity, but that is about transcendence, about the possibilities of ordinary human beings becoming superhumans.
Prajit, thank you so much. So if we had more time, I'd also want to be hearing lots more about all of the other things that you talk about in this chapter, but I'll just highlight very briefly for listeners who are particularly interested in the way that the book engages the sensory world, right? We talked a little bit about color and light, heat. There's a really interesting discussion here in this conclusion on oral, A-U-R-A-L, therapies, so sound. And the way that sound is actually potentially part of this story. So check out the conclusion if you are interested in sound studies, listeners, and you'll find a lot of good stuff there. So Prajit, there's obviously, right, a ton of things that we haven't had a chance to talk about. It's an extraordinarily rich book. Given that, though, is there anything in particular that you'd like to mention that didn't come up in the course of our conversation, perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to become readers?
I guess we've covered most of the things that I would really want to talk about. I want to reiterate once more my commitment to this idea of braiding as a way of getting out of a kind of encounter framework where there's the West and the non-West and they somehow collide, and even if there are friendly exchanges, that it's between two homogenous wholes. So I'm trying to get away from that, and hopefully that will find some greater traction. And on that score, I also think that the book, I want to make a bid that the book is of interest to historians of science more generally, and not just to historians of medicine, because I think Ayurvedists in the period that I'm studying thought of it as a science and not just medicine, and drew upon a whole palette of other sciences, including the physical sciences, the chemical sciences. The conversations that I document in the book are of between them and a whole range of European sciences that cannot just be reduced to the medical. So the one thing I would like to also, along with braiding, emphasize is that this book, I hope, will be of interest to even those historians of science who are not interested in the history of medicine per se.
Excellent. Now that the book is out, aside from the book that I'm going to convince you eventually to write about fiction and history of science and medicine, and we'll get there. And that should be easy, right? I mean, if you can write a chapter in like 8 hours, that's like, right, like a weekend's work or something. But aside from that, what's next for you? What are you currently working on and inspired by?
So I am getting quite deep into my next project at this point. And there's what I'm interested in is, it's still not fully articulated though, in thinking about the way we think of group inheritance. And let me, this sounds even worse than it does in my head now that I say it. but basically what is of interest to me is a longer history of genetics in India, which has become quite a big field, acquiring a lot of government funding. And that has that's not recent, that goes back almost to it does actually go back to the very beginnings of classical genetics. And that has kind of increasingly biologized our idea of inheritance in a way. But I want to play that off, that story of the history of genetics off with other parallel stories, such as there was a thriving field of parapsychological research that was looking into reincarnations that until recently was not really quack science, but considered good science until the end of the Cold War. There was another discipline called craftology that I'm really interested in, where people were trying to think of group inheritance through the study of folk arts. And I want to think of how do we think of when we think of who our ancestors are, and this is a question that is in many ways, even if not always explicitly owned up to, I think is a very important question in South Asia, what our past was, who our ancestors were. And we've increasingly zeroed in on a kind of genetic way of answering that question and left out all the other sort of parapsychological, craftological ways of answering that question. And that's what I'm playing around with. So inheritance as a problem. I'll leave it at that.
Well, best of luck with that project, Parjeet. And that's also going to make a fabulous book. So thank you for taking time away from that to talk with me about this book. Best of luck. And it's really been a pleasure. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much, Carla. I should also mention maybe just one last thing, that if anybody looks at the book, I mean, even if you don't read it, look at the book. I'm very proud of the cover. It was, my wife designed it, so which is why I really, really, we sent a whole bunch of different designs, of which only this one was designed by her, to the press. And they, without knowing that it was by my wife, chose to go with this. So I'm really proud of it. So even if I'm not sure if I'm proud of the book, but I'm proud of the cover.
Thank you. You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.